countdown is on.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the morning open, a look at the broader economy as trading gets started for the day. We're about 20 minutes into it, so let's ask the question, where's Wall Street? Markets are up, barely. The S&P up less than a tenth of a percent. Same for the Dow at 98.34. The NASDAQ up about a quarter of a percent. European markets slightly higher right now as well, under half a percent. And shares in Asia closed mostly lower today, those that were open today. The Federal Reserve wraps up its two-day meeting this afternoon. The board will make an announcement on interest rates and the health of the economy. If only we could hear the discussions leading up to that announcement. Richard DeKayser is president of Woodley Park Research. He joins us live right now from Washington. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So are Fed members, board members on the same page when it comes to the best way to proceed?
Yes and no. I think basically they're in agreement, and I certainly wouldn't expect any major discord at this latest meeting, and we're likely to see, I would even assert, a unanimous decision on leaving interest rates where they are. But what we are seeing is a little bit more separation in point of view. We're starting to see the so-called hawks talking about removing monetary accommodation, that is, the timing and magnitude of interest rate increases. And then we're seeing the more dovish members, those who favor being a little bit more patient, talking about the need to see the economy get up on its own legs before being too aggressive. So we're starting to see a little bit of a split. I wouldn't exaggerate the case. These folks do not get into barroom brawls. They're a very courtly crew. But a little bit of a division is beginning to emerge.
So which of those voices win in the end, do you think? I mean, what happens? Who, you know, voices of optimism, or where do we go?
Well, I think at the moment that is likely to be the case. Of course, the big dog is Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, and he does command a tremendous amount of respect, and his position holds sway. So I think that patience is likely to prevail. And again, the question is not anything having to do with the near term, but when eventually they start to raise interest rates and how quickly they do so. So at the moment, again, the doves, if you'd like, are firmly in control.
And speaking of interest rates, we got word this morning about mortgage applications rising last week to the highest level since May. The Mortgage Bankers Association says not only refinancing, but applications for home sales were robust. I mean, very quickly, are people buying houses?
Yeah, they are. You're right. Both refis and purchase applications have been rising since roughly February this year. That shows the consequences of this low interest rate policy and the importance of maintaining it to keep this housing recovery that's just nascent at this point moving forward.
All right. Richard DeKayser, thanks for being with us this morning.
My pleasure.
All right. Tomorrow, a congressional oversight panel will look at credit rating agencies. Those are the analysts who give healthy ratings, or gave them, to complex security investments, even though they were full of shaky subprime assets. The Securities and Exchange Commission last week adopted new rules to require more accountability from those rating agencies. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale says some in Congress are trying to go even further.
The credit rating industry is dominated by three big players, and Congress is considering proposals to inject more competition. One idea is to no longer require that banks and pension funds use a certified rating agency to analyze their investments. Christopher Whalen, who follows rating agencies for Institutional Risk Analytics, says that would allow more ratings companies to sell their services.
You will not have a de facto two-and-a-half company monopoly, as we call it, Moody's, S&P being the two, and then Fitch Ratings being the third, where a whole class of investors have to use one of these three companies. That will disappear.
Tomorrow, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee hears from a whistleblower who worked at Moody's. Reports say he raised questions about some of that firm's inflated ratings, claiming Moody's issued positive assessments the company knew were not supported by the financial evidence. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
In just a few moments, President Obama will give an important first speech to the UN General Assembly. He calls on other nations to step up. The president plans to proclaim a new spirit of unity in tackling global problems. He'll use words such as partnership and cooperation. And Ford wants to get into the Indian small car market. Today, it unleashed the Figo, which means cool in Italian. The four-door is expected to sell for under $10,000. The automaker also has plans to export the car to other Asian nations. Today, China offered some support to a U.S. plan to build a more balanced global economy. The proposal would shrink surpluses in big exporting countries, such as China, and boost savings in nations with big debt, such as the United States. This comes as world leaders get ready to meet in Pittsburgh tomorrow for the Group of 20 Nations conference. Ahead of that, the EU today unveiled a plan to overhaul the way banks and financial markets are overseen. Marketplace European correspondent Stephen Beard is with us from London to talk about it. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Steve.
So what's all this in a nutshell?
Well, this really is designed to remedy what was seen as the major problem in Europe, which aggravated the credit crunch and the financial crisis. That is a lack of coordination between the regulators and the institutions within each of the 27 member states. So what this draft plan today proposes is a series of Europe-wide bodies to monitor and reduce financial risk. I mean, there is, for example, a risk board which will try to spot problems like the credit crunch before they actually blow up into a crisis and try and head them off. And also there'll be regulatory bodies looking Europe-wide at the banks, the insurers, and the financial exchanges.
Now, Stephen, this is proving quite controversial, especially in Britain. Why?
Well, Britain has always jealously guarded its financial centre. It is the biggest in Europe and the most profitable. It's always very suspicious of moves from continental Europe to control its financial centre. And these bodies are going to have Europe-wide powers. I mean, a European regulator is going to be able to tell a national regulator the action he should take. So the Brits are likely, for example, to insist that some of these boards have a very strong British representation on them. For example, the deputy chairmanship, say, of the risk board might be given to the governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King.
So this obviously isn't a done deal. I mean, what happens next, Stephen?
Well, it has to be agreed by all 27 governments and also by the European Parliament. But the European Commission says this is a bold idea, an important blueprint, and it is taking it to the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh to present to other world leaders as a global blueprint, a model for what might be established globally to prevent financial crises from developing in the future.
Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
The G20 summit begins tomorrow, as we mentioned earlier, in Pittsburgh. And for decades, workers there depended on the steel industry. Way back in the 80s, that industry went away. Remind you of some recent developments? Marketplace's Rico Galliano spoke with a few Pittsburgh steelworkers to hear what it was like to live through those times and what advice they might have for auto workers in Detroit who'll have to live through these times.
I am Raymond Henderson. My age is 69. I used to be a steel worker.
My name is Greg Mowry, and I was a steel worker for 23 years.
What was it like when the mills closed?
It was terribly sad. To come past and see the buildings just standing was worse than having them torn down. Because people kept thinking, well, it's going to come back, it's going to come back. It was very depressing to come past here every day.
I had buddies that committed suicide. There were other guys that just decided they were going to drink and do drugs. You know, I was a different breed, I guess. You know, it was just a process. I knew it was going to take place, and I knew I had to go out here and find a job somewhere. They had a benefit through the steel industry and the federal government that would allow you to go back to school to re-educate yourself. And it was like a 2-year program. I became a social worker.
I did actually go to auto mechanics, got a degree in that, but it was too tough on my back. And there was 100,000 people in this valley that lost their jobs at the same time, so it was very difficult to find any kind of work.
Oh, as a steel worker, I was making something like $50,000, $60,000 a year. When I got a new job, it went down to about $23,000, $24,000 a year. You didn't eat steak anymore. You ate lunch meat.
What do you say to the people in Detroit who are maybe going through something similar?
The biggest factor is to network your friends. It's very difficult when industry cuts back all at the same time because there are no jobs available, so you have to rely on close friends, and that's how I got in a print shop. I worked with Mike Stott in the mill, and Mike called me and said, would I consider coming to work at the print shop? And that's what I became, the printer.
Best thing I can tell people in Detroit, use what you got. The automobile industry plants, they can build a whole new industry off of that. Building windmills up there, they should convert it over to that. They got to adapt quickly. And I think it can be done.
Marketplace's Rico Galliano produced that report. Today, General Mills reported a higher-than-expected quarterly profit. The maker of Cheerios and Chex was helped by strong sales in the United States. Same true for ConAgra, which reported higher profits yesterday. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the dish on why food producers are doing so well in this economy.
The short answer is it costs less to buy what it takes for companies to make the food. Mark McMinimy follows agribusiness for Concept Capital's Washington Research Group.
We are seeing commodity prices that are dramatically lower than they were a year ago in many cases.
And when they were at their high, says Morningstar analyst Aaron Swanson, companies raised the prices of their products for consumers. Now those prices remain high, even though commodities have come down. But Swanson says there's something else playing into the earnings at General Mills and ConAgra. Price-conscious consumers want brand-name products.
They want to be getting a good value for their money. A lot of times they turn to brands that they can trust.
And with more Americans eating at home these days, well-known brands from ConAgra's Healthy Choice to General Mills' Wheaties stand to benefit. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Fall. Leaves changing colors, things getting cooler, and television networks bombarding us with new fare. Two big comedies premiere tonight on ABC. Former friend Courtney Cox stars in Cougar Town about a dating divorcee. And there's another show, Modern Family, that premieres too. In fact, there are a whole lot of sitcoms on the roster this season. We give it a little fine tune with Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
NBC, Fox, and ABC are all betting big on funny. There's Hank, about a Wall Street exec who loses his job, The Cleveland Show, an offshoot of animated hit Family Guy, and Modern Family, about kids and parents trying to keep up with them.
I'm hip. I surf the web. I text. LOL. Laugh out loud. OMG. Oh my God. WTF. Why the face?
Compared to the last several years, this is a bumper crop for new comedies.
Robert Thompson is a professor of TV and pop culture at Syracuse University. He says the last few years have been all about the hour-long drama. Lost, Grey's Anatomy, Mad Men. Now, he says, networks are rediscovering the advantages of lighter fare.
When a sitcom becomes a big hit, it is so incredibly versatile. Not only are they highly rerunnable, they're also so much easier to adapt to online multi-platforming than the drama is.
That's TV speak for things like webisodes and online spin-offs. Comedies are also usually much cheaper to produce than dramas, and Thompson says in this economy, that's got all the networks smiling. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Officials in San Joaquin County, California, paid $500,000 for it. The Mobile Law Enforcement Command Center is like a travel camper on steroids. There's one problem with it, though. It's illegal to drive in California. The mobile unit was made in Ohio, where it is street legal, and for three deputies to drive it there and back 5,000 miles to get it modified so it's lighter or adds another axle, it would cost the department more than $19,000. The only emergency this thing has seen is officials looking for a cheaper fix. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.